summarise really what we've been doing. Now, the image I used for this course, and the title of this course, is The Green and Burning Tree. And that comes out of an image from the tale of Peredur that's in the Mabinogi, where the hero Peredur, who is a sort of early grail searcher, in one way of looking at him, comes to a place on a river, by a river, where there is a tree, and half of which is burning in for fire, half of which is green of leaf. There are white sheep on one side of the river and black sheep on the other, and the sheep are constantly jumping across the river and changing their colour. Now, this is an image of the tree of life and the tree of death, in a way. And the image, the certain sense. What are we doing when we look at these old stories, these old myths? We're connecting really with the sense of moving beyond the opposites, coming into a place where we become the green and burning tree, where we become able to unite opposites and work creatively with them. And in part, therefore, what we're looking at, really, we're looking at the ability to do that. What helps us to do that? What helps us to generate newness? Which is why, as well as looking at these very ancient traditions, we're also looking at people like the Inklings to see what they have made of these things. And in a certain sense, really, it's a part of what we're doing when we look back into the very ancient world of Egypt, is we're looking really, it's very helpful to do that because we can start to see the roots of things which then later developed. And one of the particular usefulnesses of ancient Egypt, partly because it has been an enormously formative place in terms of the development of the West, but also we have records, we have ways of being able to track how ideas and images have developed over time. We don't have that in Britain. You know, what we have is our archaeological remains, and we have stories collected in the early Middle Ages that incorporate much older material, but incorporate that, of course, within what for them is the modern framework, you know, of the, and at a time when the Christianity is the dominant religion, not just religion, it's the dominant ideology, you know, now obviously for people living at that time, there is a sense of the past, and the past for them really, because we go a little back from where they are, we start to come into the Dark Ages, which in a way are called the Dark Ages because there's not a lot written about them. So what they were, you know, what they were actually like, is we're dealing with a lot of supposition. Now, what we see in Britain is the hope is before the Dark Ages. Britain is part of the Roman Empire. There is a Romano-Celtic civilization that, in the main, seems to have settled down and operated, and as far as we can tell, operates very harmoniously. But as the Roman Empire disintegrates, and as the invasions from Europe, in terms of the Jutes and the Saxons and the Angles, we start to see an inevitable breakdown and change starting to happen. The other thing that we see happening is Romano Celtic civilization was very urban. Lots of river stuff. You only needed the food. They needed the food, of course, but there were, for that time, significant cities. Now, with the breakdown of the empire, the cities start to fall apart, because they are maintained by the countryside. In fact, cities are maintained by the countryside. You can't grow so much in a city. These vast cities we have all over the world, the reason that they function is because there's electrical power, there's pumping stations, there's an infrastructure that enables them to continue. And of course, there is food reaching cities, food and drink reaching cities from outside the cities. Now that all falls apart. And what happens then is you get an inevitable fragmentation where people pull into themselves. They have to. The law breaks down. If we think of these principles that the archangels hold of life and light, love and law, when in times of enormous change, these principles start to fragment. And one of the first principles that normally fragments is law. Places become lawless, out of fear, out of need, and people inevitably then pull into themselves, defend themselves. There's a pulling away from each other, and then what happens, of course, is eventually does happen is a sort of new balances get found between the Saxons, the Britons, later the Vikings, and things reorganize themselves. So you find the Saxon kingdoms emerging. You find the Bretwald ever appearing, the king of the Saxon lord of Britain. And then, of course, 1066 and all that happens when the Normans invade and then gradually impose an unified kingdom first of all in England and then the marches of Wales. And then eventually, as the British monarchies appear, at the time of Edward I, we get the annexing of Wales, the attack on Scotland, and the development of a sense of Britishness, imperial Britishness, we could say, really, which comes out of that kind of Norman tradition. Now, alongside these political developments, what happens is religious and spiritual developments. Crucially, the development of the rise of Christianity, and the rise of a centralized Christianity. Because the first versions of Christianity we get here are in the Romano British period, and they're very decentralized. Not at all like the Christianity that later appears. But at the same time, what's happening and what we also find and what gets lost in the obvious narrative is that in the Roman period in particular, and then less obviously, but there's continual movement of people and ideas and beliefs and images, so that alongside the rise of Christianity, there is Mithraism. Alongside that, there is the rise of the cult of Isis that is also imported into Britain. And so when we start thinking of the collective soul of Britain, we've got to get away from the monoglot kind of history that many of us will have been told in school. Actually, when we look into the reality of history, what we see is a lot of blurring, a lot of compromise, a lot of transmission, a lot of things going on, a lot of contact between peoples. We've particularly lost these days the understanding of the sea roads and the fact that that certainly if you're in Wales, you're having a lot of contact with Ireland, a lot of contact with Brittany. You know, there was, actually, literally, a lot of contact with ancient Egypt. There was a lot of so the early Celtic Church was very influenced by the Church Fathers of Egypt. So we have to see a sort of a seething of ideas. This is a time in the world when things are breaking down, things are happening, the destruction of the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire, I mean, it's a little like we're seeing the destruction of the American Imperium at the moment. And so what's literally happening is America, you know, I imagine particularly under Trump, we're going to see more and more of that, where America has been this imperial power with bases all over the world. And it now looks like it's going to go back into its isolationist mode, which periodically it does. And so you can start to see the way the world gets unbalanced. So Putin is in massively emboldened by that, but other places as well. So you start to see this kind of time, really, that's really very like the kind of the 20s and the 30s of the 20th century, where things are becoming unstable, things are changing. Now, when these things happen, then the question is, well, what do we reach for? What did they reach for? What do we reach for? And one of the things that we can start to see when we look at the Mabinogi is, and in particular the genius who writes the Four Branches, really starts to look at the things that need both pointing out and preserving. So what we see in the Mabinogi is this we're going to continue looking at it over the next few weekends, of course, because we're only looking at the first branch at the moment. But what we see is looking at, well, what's really important to understand here? What's important to transmit? Now, one of the things that the writer begins with is it's important to understand what is it like to be pen anuvin, to be one who can connect to the other world and bring the gifts of the other world through. And what the writer is showing us is how to do that, but also that some of the errors and dangers. So one of the things that we learn from the first branch is the centrality of the feminine principle, of actually the sense of going into Brosselandi, going into the wildwood. That's where this whole place begins, by going into the wildwood, going into the mysterious, going into the world of the imagination, which in these traditions is really imagined as going beyond the places that are lit and ordered into the wild, entangled woods, where there are powerful beings, interesting beings, dangerous beings, wolves and bears, and creatures of magic. Unicorns live here. And in that process, we are shown the tracking of the stag, this very ancient that keeps getting repeated in the Arthurian things. We glimpse the magical stag, and so we are drawn into the heart of the woods. And then there is a transformative encounter, which asks us to exchange. So we're asked to exchange identities. We're asked to be, in a sense, in the place of being pen anuvin. And in that place, what we're asked to do is to trust our deep intuition. And the failure of Poich, the partial failure of Poich in this. And this is an interesting device which we see echoing through the British literature. Really, you find it in the later poem of Gawain and the Green Knight, where Gawain has a game of beheading with this supernatural figure who turns up at Arthur's court, And the figure says, you know, cut my head off, and in a year and a day, I'll cut your head off. And everybody thinks, well, that's ridiculous, he'll be dead. Now, but people can feel the uncanniness of it, so nobody wants to do it apart from Gawain, who stands in Arthur's place and who cuts off the head of the Green Knight and then goes off into the, in a year and a day, there's a whole process where he goes off into the wild. And comes into this castle, the castle of Sir Bertilac, who actually is really the Green Knight. And there is a whole process where they things are given to Gawain, and the idea they make a pact that anything that Bertilac goes hunting in the forest, and will give him the fruits of whatever he hunts. Whatever Gawain gains in the day by being in the castle, he will also give to Bertilac. And part of the story is that we have the lady of the castle, who is seductive and beautiful, and who on the first day kisses him. And so when Bertilac turns up, he kisses Bertilac and is given the fruits of the hunt. Second day she kisses him, he exchanges the kiss. But the third day she gives him a green girdle, which she says will protect him from all danger. And this he keeps for himself. And then in the denouement, when he turns up, he wraps the girdle, thinking he's going to keep him safe. And then he encounters the Bertilac in his green knight form. And the green knight says to him that you have failed the test. And actually what he does is just, instead of cutting off his head, he nicks him so that his neck bleeds, therefore proving to him that the girdle hasn't worked. And actually what he should have done is surrendered the girdle, surrendered into death, and then surrendered into transformation. Now, so this motif of the partial success, which we find in Pwyll, becomes something that becomes then a sort of device of later storytellers to show you some of the deeper dynamics of the story. So what in Pwyll's place, where he doesn't sleep with the fairy woman, means therefore that then the whole story then that has to happen around Rhiannon comes into being. And what we see in this story really is the centrality of the feminine archetype, the centrality of Rhiannon. First of all, the fairy woman in the underworld, who is the creatrix, who is the giver of life in a certain sense. And what we see then is that error getting repeated right up to the end of the story, where Pryderi is given the name Pryderi, and therefore never quite fulfills his destiny as the child of light, who is Gwri the golden hair. That is his true name. And his true fosterage is taken away from him by the machinations of Pindar and Dyved. Now, what we've also looked at, and what appeared very powerfully in the first meditation, is alongside the, if you like, the material that is from Wales and from Britain, you go right back to Alexandria, to the roots of the Western mystery tradition. Because what happens when we enter the House of Life, we encounter the teacher and the veiled goddess, who takes us down into the catacombs of Cumul Shafaka. And in a way, one of the things that, you know, that we could, many times and places in Egypt we could go to connect to the figure of the opening of the ways, but it's specifically this time, specifically that place, because of the fusion of influences. Because what we're looking at, and when we come back to this idea of being the green and burning tree, is we're looking at the bringing together of opposites and influences, and to see, well, what is the what is it needed now? What needs to emerge to be made new, to come through us and our particular understanding? And in the meditation, we're taken down into the earth, we're taken down into the sarcophagus chamber, which turns out to be our sarcophagus, we're suggested to visualize ourselves as a mummy, with the mummy wrappings, with all the amulets, and we are raised up by Anpu and Apuat, the jackal lords of resurrection, and have given the experience of the face-to-face counter beneath the veil with the goddess. So this private, intimate encounter with the source of life. When we visit the house of life this morning, we find the house of life modified by that encounter. We find that Alexandrian current connecting to our own house of life. It's still our house of life, and that current can either be cultivated or allowed just to be there, or asked to leave. No harm in any of those things, whatever feels and is right for you. But in a certain sense, really, by being on this course, because this is the tradition I come from, you're inevitably going to be impacted by that tradition. And how much you get interested in that is a private matter for you. The importance, though, of this tradition, and why we've looked at both Egyptian tradition and British tradition today, is that the Egyptian tradition gives us a different approach to the twists and turns of patriarchy. It's not free of it, because all human systems religions have this, but it is actually quite different, and in some ways easier, because of the overt acknowledgement of the power of the divine feminine. The understanding also of what are gods is much more sophisticated in ancient Egypt than it is. Our problem when we think about divinities, divine, we have the image of the god in the sky of our childhood, which cognitively we don't, of course, believe in, but somewhere lurks at the back of our unconscious. So this idea of now, what the ancient Egyptians, the symbol for one of the gods in ancient Egypt, is a flag and a flagpole. And so what the quality of the Egyptian gods is that they are these like pillars that unite earth and heaven, and they are these moving shapes. The flags were long flags that would take up had a particular colour and a particular, depending on how the wind caught it, a particular kind of movement. So they're very much, very close to what Jung describes as the archetypes of the collective unconscious. They are the work, the kind of experience you get through the encounter, say with Sobek, is different from the encounter that you will get from Hathor. And in a way, there's a part of what we're looking at here, as we become the green and burning tree, is an understanding of how do we work with these ancient images and powers. And I mean, Jung was very careful about these things, and warned a great deal about the idea of possession by an archetype. And possession by an archetype really is where the sense of our ordinary human nature is somehow pushed aside by the archetypal quality. That's very easily done. It's one of the things you run into in Glastonbury very frequently is people who think they're Merlin, or people who think they're Morgan Le Fay, and the way their kind of normal personality has become displaced by the connection to an archetypal energy. Now, one of the things that was always interesting about Ernest and when he talks about his teacher, very often people who know about Ernest and his connection to the opener of the ways have assumed that he's working with the Egyptian god Anubis. And Ernest was always very clear to say, no, my teacher is a living man. I must live in another world, but he is a human being who connects with the ancient Netaru Anpu and does the work of opening the ways for people. And in a certain sense, this is the approach that we need to have to humanize the archetypes, to find a way of working with them that is creative. Generally speaking, what happens with the ancient Egyptian Netaru, you get drawn to. So for me, figure of Anubis is very important. The one who is also Apuat, who opens the way. So his concern with healing and resurrection and opening ways are, speak to me. You know, and they said, of course, the job as a psychotherapist, much of my life has been to do with opening new ways, finding ways of helping people heal and resurrect themselves, trying to do that for myself. So in a way, that there's a sort of a natural kind of attraction to the different archetypal forms. And in a way, there's something about finding our own connection to that and working creatively with that. You know, the other figure I relate to is the god Thoth, who is both the archetypal priest and also the writer. So that is something else that, you know, comes easily to me. So in a certain sense, when we work with these archetypal stories, archetypal forms, there's something about trusting our own intuition, our own will, our own capacity to connect to different forms, but to be careful in the way that we do that, that we are not lost within the archetype. There's a phrase in the Gospel of Thomas, the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, that applies to this, and it says, "Blessed be the man who eats the lion and it becomes man. Cursed be the man whom the lion eats and becomes lion." And what this phrase is saying is, you could be swallowed by an archetype. So if the lion eats you and you become lion, you become leonine, you become this charismatic, powerful, dramatic figure. But actually you have lost your heart in that process, because that's all you are. Now, then you're just lion. Writer Charles Williams, in one of his novels, I can't remember the bloody title of at the moment, but he writes in one of his novels about this very topic, the many dimensions. Spare me a second, I'll just find it. No, it's the place of the lion. No, actually, it's the place of the lion, it's a very good story, the place of the lion. He has this idea of a mystic who falls into a kind of a trance and who's been working with the ancient, working with the archetypes, but he's a clear channel for them. And because he's in trance and can't stir himself, these archetypal energies start to come into the world and possess people. There's a woman who becomes very, very snake-like and seductive, and somebody else who gets possessed by the lion and becomes very dominating. And in the story, there's one person who consciously takes on himself the place of the innocence of the unicorn, and therefore has the capacity to work with the other, feel like archetypal spirits, and to help them return to where they need to be and to bring the person out of his trance. There's a really, it's, I mean, it, I mean, it, you know, it, not the easiest of writers, Charles Williams, but that's, if you're interested in that sense of the possession by archetypes, that story really explores that in quite a powerful kind of way. Okay. Now, when we come, so to come back to these meditations, really, both the Druidic meditation and the Egyptian meditation, where we're looking at this particular image of the innocent child who brings the opposites together and who is the new energy, the new life that enables something new to happen. Now, that kind of quality of innocence and newness, and also there's a sort of indestructibility about it that takes us right into the heart of things, into the beginning place, the point of the beginning. Now, this is something that you find this very much in the Kabbalah, the idea that it's called the work of Bereshit, the work of creation, where in every moment the world is recreated. And so what we do when we meditate, we come into the body, we come into presence, we come into stillness, we return to the point of the beginning. And then we and the world are recreated from there, moment by moment. Now, this is a tradition that the Hebrews derive from directly out of ancient Egypt, because in ancient Egypt, the Egyptian priests, we in their acts of creation, begin always with returning to something they call Zeptepi, the first time, the first moment. So when we did the Egyptian meditation, we quite consciously went into the moment when there is just the waters of chaos, or there is no formation. And what we start to see then is the separation of the wet and the dry, which is the arising of the first mound that is the first pyramid out of the waters. And then the appearance of the sun. And then the sense of the enthronement. And then the appearance of the jet pillar, which becomes the tree of life, out of which everything then is generated. Now, this is the very earliest, in a sense, earliest form of this. And actually, if you think about it, you think of the beginning of Genesis in the Bible, you'll see a lot of resonances with this ancient Egyptian story, cast in a slightly different form, of course, because it's a slightly different religious system. Now, that sense of the return to the beginning, the return to the sense of innocence, the return of the becoming the child, whether it's the child Horus or little Gwion, is that sense of touching that place in us that is our beginning point, the singularity, the simple center out of which everything else grows. So it's like a bit like resetting ourselves, returning to the beginning, realigning our presence, and then allowing the sense of movement to arise out of there, and following that movement and trusting it. When we invite the archangels to come in, this is literally what we do. We begin by getting centered, by entering our center, by noticing space around us, and then by inviting in, of course, first the presence of Raphael, who is the angel of beginningness, the first breath, the quality of inspiration and life. And as we move around the circle, inviting successively the quality of Michael and the quality of light, Gabriel and the quality of love, Uriel and the quality of law, we are reshaping our world, recreating our cosmos, bringing Sandalphon and Metatron to guard the depth and the height, and then inviting Servuviel to bring it all into a new weaving. So in that moment, we recreate the world. We're in that reset place, then getting curious about what happens next. And so both the Egyptian meditation and the kind of Welsh meditation are just helpful ways of just play, of just experimenting more directly with that sense of resetting. So the kind of the images there, and the, I mean, you have the triskele image for the Druidic meditation. I've also sent you all a copy of the Horus image that we looked at on the screen. So if you want to continue to work with that, you can use that image. But importantly to remember, you know, the whole point of this course is not that we become expert in mythologies, or if, well, that's fun, that's what I like to do, but that isn't the heart of it. The heart of it is to be the green and burning tree, to be the place that is rooted in the earth, extended into space, that can bring together opposites and enable the quality of transformation in both ourselves and in those around us. And I suppose in a way, when I think back down the years, and I think about Tom and Ernest, these were these, you know, they're both, you know, quite old men when I knew them. Although old doesn't seem so old now, actually. My advanced years. I don't, you know, but I, you know, sort of, you know, if I knew Tom, he was only in his 60s, actually, but Ernest was in his late 70s. But they were both really were green and burning trees. They had this power of life in them, curiosity about things, and a willingness to jettison all that they had previously known, and a curiosity to where is the next edge coming from somewhere. And in a way, that's kind of all that's required of us, actually, in a certain sense. If we just get still and present and notice, well, what's the next thing? What is coming? What am I drawn to? Now, these forms and methods and meditations are helpful aids, but that is almost the central thing. Just get present. Just notice the unfolding. Follow it. Be curious. And of course, one of the places our curiosity has brought us to this weekend is back into relationship with the Middle Kingdom figure of Sobek Neferu, who I've occasionally encountered, and some of you might never have encountered before. But again, you may not be interested in looking into her, but if you feel drawn in that direction, go back to the meditation. Follow it, see what happens. Trust, above all, really, trust your own unfolding here. So let's see, we've got about 10 minutes left. So let's just see if there's any questions or things people want to say or ask about before we wrap it up for the weekend. About anything for the weekend or anything, truthfully, really.
I've got a question. Oh, yep. I was just going to say, so shall we just go where we're drawn? So if we're not so drawn to the Egyptian, go with the other one? Or is it good to sort of challenge ourselves and kind of... Or is it just...
Well, I think it's something that, right, that's a genuinely interesting question, Faye, I think, because it kind of depends really on what's happening, and we have to be, and part of what we need to learn to do is to discriminate between when something is purely intuitive or whether it's habit. So sometimes, if we never challenge ourselves, we remain contained within the boundaries of the things we have known in the past. So sometimes it's worth, if we kind of listen to our intuition, it's worth challenging that and getting interested in something else. Other times it's wrong to do that, but you can only do that by experimenting and trusting what happens. So, I mean, my general rule of thumb would be, if you normally find yourself contained within one world, then try something else and see what happens. Try it out for a little while. See, does it, and if it brings benefits, great, you continue it. If it doesn't, drop it. If, on the other hand, some people are the opposite and find themselves bouncing from one thing to another thing to another thing, then, oh, well, maybe contain yourself to one thing and see what that happens. In a certain, as a rule of thumb, what we need to do is to challenge our habitual patterns. So if we're going to bring ourselves into the new, we have to notice, well, what is it I habitually do? And am I doing this just because I always do that? What happens if I try something different?
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I had a little something just going around in my head that this whole weekend has really either helped with or made me think about the myth structures that you've been talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about the beginning of the Arthurian cycle in a way before Arthur.
Yeah.
That it begins with the fatal flaw, that the trick. Arthur is born out of a trickery.
Yes, that's absolutely. No, totally.
And then I'm thinking also of the Mabinogion. There's the four branches. It doesn't necessarily have to start there, does it? Because it was put in a particular order. But the first branch begins with, in a way, the mistake of Puss,
yeah.
of actually sending his hounds in. And then everything unfolds from that.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking as well, in the Egyptian, I was thinking, what's the equivalent of that? I was thinking, is it Osiris going into the coffin that was built by Set? This is for you. Does it fit you? And yeah. I don't know if that was hubris or just a bit of stupidity in a way.
Yeah.
That then Isis, in a way, she becomes active after that mistake. And then in the... I suppose in Genesis, thinking of the apple, and then everything unfolds from that moment. So almost as though the story would not happen, life would not happen, unless there was some kind of monumental fuck-up or mistake, something. So it's almost like made me think of that in a different way, because partly I just feel like, oh, I just want an easy life, that there's no mistakes, there's no... You know, nothing goes wrong, and I do the right thing all the time. But it's almost like this great drama in each of the traditions unfolds in a way. The wisdom stories it wouldn't have happened unless something profoundly, deeply went wrong through perhaps different things.
No, I think so that's... I think that's absolutely right. I think, in a certain sense, that because that place in all of us where we just want things just to be perfect and to happen and do the right thing all the time, in a sense, is I mean, that's almost a shadow of the child, right? That's the play, and it's the place where, that, as Penny was pointing out earlier, that Prideri never really grows out of somewhere. You know, because there's something about that having to address the things that go wrong, that wake us up, that develop our capacities, that enable our creativity to function. So that, and in a way, that's exactly it. The great, all the great wisdom stories have that. For example, in Egypt, one of the things that, one of the reasons why Isis is the great enchanter is that she tricks Ra into giving him his secret name, because Ra's gone a bit senile and kind of needs her help, so that sense of the trickery or flaw or something wrong that then is creatively expressed is at the root of all the great stories, really.
Now, I was thinking in a way, it just followed on from that, thinking about the act of baptism, the immersion into water, and I suppose it doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian thing, but almost like each human being can become the child,
That's right.
By immersion into water, And I suppose being marked or going into water, the symbolic act, or almost like a death into life, even with the newborn.
Well, that's right, and it's why, in a sense, in the meditations that we do with the House of Life, we begin with this phrase of, now do I descend into the inner sea? Right, so that's an inner baptism each time, an inner immersion that begins, so we dissolve a sense of outerness, we enter into the House of Life. When we return from the House of Life, we dissolve that form and arise in new forms. So that continual process of immersion and return, you know, is very fundamental. Ernest is to say, it's an alchemical term, the flyer must descend into the sea. And by the flyer, he means our normal, active kind of consciousness, that it must descend into the deep waters in order to, and in that sense, die, really, and die and be dissolved by the, and then be reformed by the depths.
Thank you. This idea of mistakes and deviating from the path.
Yeah.
I'm relating it to our lives. I don't think we should. It presupposes that there is a path for us. I don't think there is. I think the path is made by walking the path. You know, I mean, the mess ups are our own, but they don't. I don't think every single minute changes our story.
Totally.
By the actions in this minute. That's all. Rather than, I think there's a lot of stuff thought in the present sort of spiritual context that there should be a path for everyone, and that, you know, we should try and it happens in Christianity. Is it encouraging Christianity? You know, all the hymns I sang used to be, you know, you choose now and you choose forever, you know, twixt that darkness and that light, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just nonsense. It's just life. Mm-hmm. And we're human beings, so we mess up. But if we can keep the sense of the child, I think we can be quite happy about that.
I think that's absolutely right.
Path. It's like feeling you've got a bloody destiny, you know. Like thinking you were Cleopatra in a reincarnation or something. It's overweening, really.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, and I think what... So I think we have tendencies, we have things we're attracted to, and by our nature, we're interested in particular things. But the path absolutely is made by walking the path. You know, the whole idea of the Tao, really, is the Tao is this mysterious unfolding. And you know, it's... You know, but of course, as you say, there are belief structures that say, you know, there is a, it's normally the path they believe in, that they think is the path that everybody should follow or be punished by, you know, for not following. Whereas actually, you know, when we pay proper attention to these things, there is an unfolding of the path, and sometimes we feel like we separate ourselves from our own integrity, and we then have to find our way back to that, you know, and that's again very human and very normal.
So with the unfolding of the first path, it's rather like a sat nav, you know. If Puck messes up one way, because he's a hero, therefore he does have a destiny. Sat nav takes him around all these convolutions.
I like that. I like that image of it as a sat nav, because that's perfect, because that's exactly what happens, and you just see, you know, and it's. I mean, it is interesting, I think, just as we look at when we look at the four branches, because the other branch, we can look at the other stories as well, because the roots of the Arthurian things are actually in the other stories, not in the four branches. But the four branches, because they're written by one person in such an extraordinary kind of way, give us a real understanding of the thinking and the imagination that was at work at that time somewhere. And I think we really do get, from the four branches, you really do get that sense of the distortion between male and femaleness. and the way in which those older traditions of the divine feminine have become really pushed away somewhere. And there's just that wonderful line, "Never was a man more stupid than you," says Rhiannon de Puig. And then at the later point when she's encouraging Gwawl, "Oh, my hero, please go and please go jump in the pack." And he's got, "Oh, right then, yeah, lovely dear." You just see the kind of the deeper intelligence, really, of Rhiannon around with these kind of Celtic warlords. Extraordinary.
I like the first one because she actually does it on their wedding day. But I particularly like the one before that when he's chasing her and she said, "It would have been better for your horse if you'd asked me the first time." You know, sort of just think about the horse, man, and just be polite.
That's right, that's right. Very nice.
Bye-bye, I need to go. Goodbye.
Yes, okay, we're just about to finish, Andy. Take care.
Hi, Andy.
Bye-bye,
okay.
Ronnie.
Bye-bye. Okay, anybody left with anything burning just before I thank the archangels?
Apart from their tree.
Huh?
Apart from their tree.
Oh, their tree, the burning tree. Yeah, very good. Nope. Okay, so let's just come into ourselves for a moment and just remember the archangels that are holding us. Zuviel, we thank you for holding the thread and connecting us to the weave. Sandalphon in the deep, we thank you. Go in peace. Metatron in the heights, we thank you. Go in peace. Auriel, keeper of the law, we thank you. Go in peace. Gabriel, the keeper of love and evocation, we thank you. Go in peace. Mikael, Lord of Light, we thank you. Go in peace. Raphael, who breathes us into new life, we thank you. Go in peace. May we all go in peace. Thank you very much, everybody. We'll see thee in the beginning of March in the room, which will be nice.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Take care of yourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do well all.
Thanks.
Have a good evening.